Would anyone like to ask or share anything?
I'd like to ask. It said on the instructions, I think, that Vedana was a weak link in the chain of suffering. So I'm wondering, in what way is it a weak link, and what does it mean?
Yeah. Do you want to say loud enough for them to hear, or you want me to say?
It said on the notice board, like in the instructions, that Vedana, feeling tone, was a weak link in the chain of suffering. So I'm wondering what that means, like that it's a weak link.
Can you hear? No? So on the board, there's something posted, I think, since yesterday about Vedana, which I talked about 2 days ago, maybe, here. That when we talked, my interpretation of what maybe when science talks about the midbrain as the emotional brain, I think it's, we talked about mind states, emotions, and I think it's not so much emotion as Vedana, the filter, the war, the taking as ally or enemy or neither. In a kind of really primal filter, primal kind of survival kind of mode. So the, it's a kind of quotation from Gautam Buddha that Vedana is a weak link in the chain of suffering. So the way things usually unfold in our programming is that we don't notice, if we go back to that talk a couple of afternoons ago where I mentioned Jogen Trungpa describing us as sort of like, it's too big, and then I'd rather take myself as being in here, which means there's something out there, which means actually I'm too small to deal with this. It's too much for me. So I need allies, and I've got to fight the enemies, and everything else I can't deal with until I win the war, and then I'll live. So this, that primal warfare, primal survival mode. So the chain starts with that ignorance, that turning away from, in a way, we can say how big it is, but also how good. So today, the fourth fault of the nature of mind is, so it's the nature of mind, the nature of reality is too easy for us, too close for us, too deep. And then today, the fourth one is too wonderful. It's too wonderful for us to grok, to process in the way that we think we're supposed to process everything, which would be like prefrontally or with our understanding of our psychology, with our somehow our id and our super ego and our ego. And of course we can't. So first we fail to realize that, yes, it would be too much for me if I were just that one little bit, that separate bit. Of course, reality is too much for that separate bit, if it were separate. If I am just me, the individual as I think of myself, yes, it's too much. And that experience of it being too much could rather feed into our wisdom. We could realize, maybe it's too much for the way I understand myself and life as a survival game. Rather than, it's too much, it's too much, it's too much, it's too much, it's too much. We never stop and go back to the original question. Too much for who? If it's too much, maybe, yeah, it's too much for this little cup. Do we need the cup? Is the cup okay being full, half full, empty, whatever, and still everything else can go on? And so then instead we keep feeling something's not quite right, something's not quite right, something's wrong, something's missing. Instead of taking that as something's missing, what's missing? I feel something's missing. So it's like, I'm the cup. Something's missing. Yes, that's true. It's missing because we've defined ourselves incorrectly. We've identified with something too small. But no, we never get encouraged to take the time and the space and give energy to feeling. Could that sense that something's missing lead in another direction to find wholeness? And so we move from the feeling, something's wrong, something's not enough, something's missing, trying to get something to fill the hole, the H-O-L-E hole, to make it feel like it's not missing, nothing's missing, but what can I find and stick in there? That's the second link in the chain of suffering. And again, we aren't encouraged to notice that it never really works. It doesn't ever make it feel whole by getting something and trying to...
Which was the second link?
It's craving would be the normal translation, tanha, thirst. Something's missing, something's missing, something's missing. I'm so poor, something's so poor, something's not enough. I'm not enough, the world's not enough. Meditation's not enough. Whatever. The not enough feeling is the second one. After ignorance and then not, which is a turning away from the brightness, the bigness, the shutting down, ignoring, not knowing what we know, not feeling what we feel, not loving what we love. And then having misdefined ourselves, we've defined ourselves incorrectly, we put ourselves in this little jail, and then we also don't notice how uncomfortable we are being in jail. And we don't take that discomfort as a good sign. Something would like to get out of jail. We take it as, something's wrong with me that I want to get out of jail, or something like that. If only I could decorate the jail or whatever. Get air conditioning in the jail. Face it toward the wind so I've got a breeze, or so on. And so each time we try, okay, now I'll try that to fix myself. Instead of redefining the whole question, I try to fix my wrong definition of myself by sticking something else there. And that's called becoming in the Buddhist language. I'm trying to fix. Instead of questioning the whole not enoughness project. The becoming is the not enoughness project. I'm trying to fix something. So let's say I come to meditation because I want to fix myself. Mm-hmm. So then I'm becoming a meditator, but I'm not then allowing meditation to go deep, to resonate with that natural freedom. I'm trying to become free. So I've got a version in my mind. I imagine freedom, and I keep trying to make it fit that map that I have instead of using the map to feel, maybe that's that, maybe that's wrong, because I feel this. We're not given that confidence. We're not encouraged to have that clarity. And also, we don't let ourselves. And so then all of this is all kind of a setup around this primal warfare filter of Vedana. If I'm already running and I already feel like I'm not enough, then my way of knowing is through the filter rather than directly. My way of knowing is, are you going to help me become a meditator? Are you going to help me become enlightened? Or are you in my way? Are you trying to stop me from becoming? So if I'm, whatever I'm trying to become, whatever I'm addicted to, whatever idea I'm addicted to, whatever ideology I'm addicted to, whatever I think is going to save me, are you going to help me get it? Are you in my way? And if you're not either one, I don't even notice you. Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Filter. That's the Vedana. So the Vedana is the weak link because it shifts us from the really primal, but raw material. Like it's a bit raw, a bit kaccha. Like there's still some possibility of, maybe we could say, falling flat on our face and then kind of, okay, from this perspective, I can question everything. We really, with Vedana, we start to experience the world according to how we set up our experiment, according to our preset intention or view, the view. The view becomes our reality through this Vedana. So it's not just that I like wind and yellow and whatever, anything, salt. But salt is good, yellow is good, wind is good. We start to depend on our preferences rather than depending on our experience. And we experience our preferences as real instead of as preferences. So Vedana is a weak link because it happens so fast and it then makes it all seem real, what is unreal. It makes what's really the only thing that's sort of out of place seem like the only thing that we can, that's true. And then we're kind of lost for a while, and then it falls apart, and we can start again. Okay. This is too much for me. I don't know anything after all these years of meditating. I don't know anything. I better go and get something. I better go get some knowledge or some experience or some hit of something. And then the addiction pulls us, and then we believe it, and then we go around again. And I think it's also a weak link because as we start to notice that it's just simply my preference or my programming, not even preference, but programming, both. And that the preference is also allowed to be there, that programming has happened, those impressions have happened. They can also get changed. They got built and they'll start to fall apart and they get impacted by experience and it shifts and eventually it could be gone. But it can be going on, but I don't have to buy into it. I don't have to believe it. I don't have to take as real what feels so real. And so then it's also a weak link in the sense of letting that the cause and effect sequence of our experience doesn't have to go towards suffering. It can go towards opening, towards our true nature, towards having those big questions, towards that just different perspective. So there are some teachings that talk about the human being between heaven and earth. And that a single discriminating thought, so a single thought that believes my preferences, my primal warfare, that takes my Vedana as true. Just a single movement of believing Vedana, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. But then we can also take the other side, which is when that's quiet or we take it as a joke, that just because I like green, I think green is the best color. And I can have slowly all these reasons why it's the best color and so on. All my experiences keep backing up why it's the best color because I'm open to it. And so when that's quiet, there could be the preferences, but it's a joke, it's funny. Or then also sometimes the preferences are more quiet and there's openness to our perceptions in a different way. And so it can be fun to play with that, like looking at something, first of all, that you never noticed before. That can happen in life and on retreat, that you've done the same walk around the ashram every day, or you've always stood there, or you've sat there, or whatever, and today you notice that bush or that rock, and as if it was never there before. Or you've been looking at that same tree every single day, but today you just let the eyes and the tree meet with a bit of softness maybe in the eyes, and you also maybe pause a little bit longer and a little bit longer and a little bit longer. And something of beauty can happen in a way that's not what I was looking for. So there, beauty starts to come out of the tree, kind of. It can be fun to play with something that you slightly didn't like you slightly have something against whatever, dirt or plastic or whatever, this bell, that sound. It's, I think, good with something we can look at, because sound, it comes and goes, and so it can be, we can get confused, but with something that we can just look at, even if it is changing all the time, somehow slowly or quickly, but we have a bit more time to play around with what I was coming to this tree with, like my idea of tree, or my idea of sunset, or whatever, my memories of trees, or dirt, all my ideas about dirt. And then gradually just, there's just color. There's light and dark and color. And sometimes a softness happens and everything is beautiful. Or at least the richness of it can come across. And so then the human being, so in one teaching they talk about the human being as the bridge over the abyss, so like a bottomless hole between the visible and the invisible, and human beings as the bridge. So we notice a big hole and we're like looking for the bridge. We're trying to reach the invisible, trying to understand the visible, trying to be free of the visible, whatever. And it's just like letting ourselves be the bridge. Or that idea yesterday of the dervish, the doorway. So letting ourselves, by actually just being with visible and invisible, with heaven and earth, with the specific and Chögyam Trungpa talks about drawing down the vastness in a single sense perception. So letting all of our expectations, memories, etc., gradually soften and maybe be funny or just quiet, and then a meeting of some kind that's also a transparency of some kind. There's not, it's not like a meeting, but there's something of that full, like full frontal meeting, and something of nothing there. The richness of the specific, and then the vastness there in that specific. Human beings open to that as what allows heaven and earth to meet. So when our expectations, images, memories, especially the meanings we have, like dirt is dirty. When we feel that in our system and let it go, and it's, we can't call it dirt anymore, maybe. Color, light, and dark.
So is it weak in the sense that it's workable? Or?
I think both. I don't know what he meant. Yeah. I think it's, I mean, it certainly is weak in the negative direction. Negative. That it's so easy to fall into assuming that my preferences are reality. That my map is reality, and going on the map instead of going on reality.
Because I thought of it as
but it's
weak.
Also weak the other way,
yeah,
I think.
In the sense that it's like the chain of suffering, like that's where you break.
Yes.
It, kind of.
I think so. And I don't know if that's what he meant, but I think it's weak in both ways. Yeah. helpfully and unhelpfully.
What did you say when you said not loving what we love? So is it that we don't acknowledge? I mean,
I didn't say that, did I? Not loving what we love?
Yeah, you said the ignorance part.
Oh. We shut down and we forget that we can love what we love.
Means we are not acknowledging. We love something or somebody or whatever.
We are love.
We are?
Love.
Loved.
Love.
Love. Okay.
Yes. And that moves. It's not just a thing. It moves. But we shut it down. Not that we, but it shuts down because...
Because?
Exactly. What is that? That's the lick.
And how does human being become a bridge between...
We are a bridge. So it's just that daring of like, okay, there's the abyss. There's the visible. There's the invisible. I experience both. And I keep getting drawn towards that abyss. And finally, it's like, okay, whatever. And as if I just give myself to that nothing, which could be like, I really don't know. Or I give up. Or I let myself be all in to loving what I love. Or some way of being 100% is as if I'm laying myself down into the abyss, not expecting anything in return. I probably will just fall and fall and fall and fall. But then, tick, invisible and invisible then can communicate, so to speak. They meet each other
but
in
you
us.
You don't know the invisible, no?
How can we not know the invisible?
I mean,
how can there be, like, if we really think and look or anything about this thing, what is this? No one knows. Science doesn't know. They still can't figure out how it happened. They have so much information and how many millions of years of bacteria, and then that all died almost out, and then all those bacteria, and that almost died out, and then all that bacteria. Still, we don't understand what this is.
And the human body.
For example,
yeah.
Or anything. I like the metaphor of the tree. We see that much of the tree, but if there's not that much of the tree that we don't see, there's not that. It's just a metaphor, but it's, what is this? Every single one of us was, you know, just... They aren't sure if it was one or two cells. And then maybe, I don't know, 24 hours later, it was eight cells. And we all went through all of those steps, having a long tail, etc., looking like an alien. Not that we also don't look like we are aliens, you know? I mean, we've gotten used to, but it's still very weird. And so that's one of the, I think about this word wonderful, kind of catching out of the corner of our eyes the surrealness of what we take as normal because we're with it all the time. We have no idea. So there's one Zen master who expressed his realization as just saying something like, two eyes, horizontal line, one nose, vertical line, something like that. And to me, it's sort of that, like there's the specific and the weirdness of it, the ordinary and the why. Why two eyes, one nose? All of us. Not one of us has two noses, one eye. Somebody else might, some other creature might, but.
In the sense that you talked about craving, I mean, in spiritual scriptures, there's all this talk about desire. And you often get this view that it's a problematic thing. And it's said that a sage is one who has no desires, kind of. So what does it mean in your sense of desire?
Desire, thirst, so a sense that something is not enough, a sense of poverty. That's how I would say it. And then taking that as the reality, which means we fear that it's the reality. We hope it isn't. And we don't stop to check. Is that all? Or what? Where would this go if I'm just quiet here? If I'm just quiet here with this feeling not enough, is that all that there is? No. There's also richness. And the richness is sort of a kind of belonging, inescapable. The not enoughness is this misunderstanding, this shutdown from our wholeness. Visible, invisible, abyss, bridge, opening. The invisible and the visible, the specific and the vast as in communication, as loving each other. And there's room for both of us, both of them in us. So in the Yoga Sutras, they talk about the two things that help. We could say the two things that help have permission or have freedom. Notice that we are free or whatever. Help us experience what is that, like from the Rumi poem, not anything that we could look at or see or find, but in the looking, in the look. Not anything closer to us than what we could experience, but also in every experience and in that that came before and that went into the experience. So in the Yoga Sutras, they suggest vairagya and abhyas as the two ways to let something sink down into our true nature, sink into our already freedom. And maybe if we take it in reverse today, so the abhyas would be, or I'm not sure which one comes first in the Yoga Sutra right now, but the abhyas would be where we keep following through our edge of discovery. We keep following through on the questions and the not knowing and letting things shift and come more and more into alignment. But we keep following through, growing a capacity to bear the wonderful, to bear the awesomeness. And vairagya is it's a different word than tanha, than thirst. So it's more about agitation and fire and heat and being activated and going beyond that activation, beyond that agitation. And mostly the way that we can go beyond the agitation is by living through. We have to taste this and that and really taste it and let that experience come through, come all the way back around as, oh, I thought it was going to be pleasant, it was actually unpleasant. I thought it was going to be fruitful, it actually took all my energy. I thought it was going to, you know, help me feel the wholeness, I feel less whole. So the full experiment, we need that permission. Usually when we do half experiment and we don't notice the results of the experiment. So we feel guilty that we want to have a second try, and there is some, and we go have the second try, but then we're not really having it.
What is the meaning of having the second child and not having it?
Like, have it. If we're going to have it, have it. Let's actually taste the chai and not taste the guilt the whole time. Have it. Enjoy it. What happens? Is it good? Does it taste good? Yes? Great. Fantastic. Like, yesterday I realized I was not so skillful about the hot water. Like, have a hot bath. Enjoy it. If you enjoy it, enjoy it. It's one of the most wonderful things on the planet. Have it. That's that would be towards a full experiment. And not just being in this power dynamic with myself of punishment, reward, permission, authority. Like, you're okay, you're not okay, you're good, you're bad, you're right, you're wrong. That whole cage. That whole cage which creates that, what we usually think of as craving. That creates that. That whole thing about good, bad, right, wrong, it requires us to be addicted. Did you want to say something? So I think that when we play sometimes with the questions, like, what is it that sees? And that encouragement from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition to find out what's too close. What is it that sees? What is it? What thinks? Where does thinking come from? What is too close? Those things that happen to you, what could be closer to you than that? Anything that happened to you. Rumi says it's closer to you than that. What could be closer than that? And then eventually we start to realize that if we try to understand in the normal way, we would break our head. We would, like, break the instrument. That's trying to understand, trying to find out. It's not going to happen that we understand in that way. If it's closer, it's not going to be found out there. If it's too close, it's not going to be even an inch or 2 centimeters or 1 centimeter or half a second later or farther. It's going to be before and behind. And I find, like, trying to feel or leave room for, okay, we see. What sees? We see. That's true. Like, okay. There's color, light, dark. But what sees? Then we can have the...
Sometimes it's difficult to make a different balance when I'm in normal life, not on a retreat. I don't can go on always quiet and inside. I have to react and to find the balance or to come back. Perhaps it's more that to come back. It's not easy.
No.
It's not only to find the balance, it's really to find back. Right?
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel a little bit like on a rope.
Mm. Yeah.
On a rope or something like that. And for me, in the last minute, there came a little film on. In further times, I had a dog. He was like this. And when I meditated, he was laying behind me. And he was really relaxed, and it was really a big support. And after 1 hour, it was enough for him. No? And I had the hands like this, and he loved tennis ball. Hmm? And he took one tennis ball really quiet, like this, and another one. And when I opened the eyes, he was there. And for me, life is sometimes like this. Mm. Perhaps it's too...
einfach simpel, but
beautiful.
To be sometimes really
good. Yeah.
And sometimes I have to become in another mode.
Yeah.
I can't explain it.
That's beautiful.
I don't have the English words to explain it more different. But this image, this little video came to me from my dog. He can do it really, no? Relax. And then plunk.
Could you hear her? Yeah?
Not really.
Shall I summarize you, or you want to you want to say briefly again that direction so they can hear you? Or I can summarize it. Feeling for how in retreat there can be the in, but life sometimes needs us to be out. And she had this image of when she meditates at home, her dog would come and be behind her, and it was a support.
It's a dog. This is what I think.
And then after 1 hour, he was ready, and he loves to, with tennis balls, he would put gently one ball here, gently one ball here. When she would open her eyes, he's there. And so she's feeling good about his teaching of being really relaxed and in the meditation, and also enthusiastic but relaxed about the invitation to play. So yeah, this tightrope gets more and more thin. It doesn't get wider, it gets more thin. It's not that the question goes away with time and practice and skillfulness developing, but rather that it becomes like a hair and maybe even nothing, and still we're walking. But there could be, what that could mean is that there might be less of like, okay, how shall I do this? But something else starts to do it. Just like we don't think about how do I balance. If I think about it, I will fall. But we can accept that the life invitations, the life challenges, the situations are not separate from the inward. Teachings.
Does it mean you can't promise us that it will be easier after some time?
That will be easier, but then that will be there. Then there's a new challenge that you are sensitive enough to feel for and accept, like willing to accept.
Yeah.
So maybe it's kind of like if we're walking on, then at first we needed the pole to balance, then the pole gets bigger and bigger, and it starts to be, whoa, how do I balance all of that? Maybe it's another metaphor. And then also there starts to be even more permission when there is retreat, which could be a quiet moment in the day, or now we're on retreat, of really being all in. And some kind of trust that something will respond. So when the life situation calls for it. So we talked the other day about guilt, responsibility, and even I would say mostly I think we hear the word responsibility as mostly guilt. And so if we could even say responsibility, responsiveness, feeling the difference, that we can trust that there will be responsiveness to life. Something will start to wake up more and more, that we are responsive, that we do care. And the less that we take caring as responsibility or burden, the less we take it with a fear about, then the more we find that we care. It's not that then we are fine, we care that much, we're done, check it off, get on with my life, no. We find that the caring actually is even more. Uh-oh. And then we feel again the guilt, the burden, and that drops, and then it's not like, again, a bigger box that I checked off. Now I'm superhuman, and now I can get on with my thing. No, it's even more. But if we could hear that not as a bad news. So the possibility that the truth of reality is that it's too wonderful. And so we could also say that how much we already care, however much we try to cover that up, however much we feel that as a problem, how much we care is wonderful news. And what's in the way is the way we take that, the way we understand that if I care, I'm required, there's a demand. But it's only because of the way I take. So I think parents and children of, if you have aging parents or friends or whatever, or if you have kids, anyone really that you know you care about, if suddenly something almost happens to them or happens to them, or you're afraid something might happen to them, or you don't want them to embarrass themselves, whatever way it happens, we flip out of just care to control. It twists. And then it isn't caring anymore. It's somehow like, oh, I don't want my friend to be so embarrassing. I don't want my friend to get hit by a bus. And so instead of just caring about your safety or your being loved or accepted or whatever, just caring and letting you be free, where there could come a protective response or a preventive response, or there could be, there was no preventing that embarrassment or whatever. But when we want to control, so if you think of a problematic relationship, there could be caring at the bottom of it. So often with our own parents, out of fear, they controlled you. They cared so much, they felt so responsible that they didn't let you just play. They didn't let you get dirty. They didn't let you experiment. And it might have been out of care, but then it twisted and became fear and control. Or they hoped. But it might have been care in the beginning and it got twisted. They hoped that you would, whatever. And they passed the internal pressure on to us. We pass our internal pressure on to them. And so the possibility of really being so with caring that we're allowed to completely care and there's no demand. And we can completely care and not pass on that feeling of demand on to the person that we care about. They can be that messy, that rude, that late. They can be that uptight, unhealthy, whatever. We can care and we might find ourselves doing something that might help them. But the freedom is first. And so just coming back to that statement of Keith Jarrett about electricity not needing to be relegated to wires, it's everywhere. So the bigness of life, letting it be everywhere and not noticing when we're relegating it, we're trying to contain it and make it follow a predictable path to prevent disaster, to prevent problems or to fix problems. Letting the vastness and beauty be in everywhere, letting it be everywhere. not only where we prefer or expect. And noticing it, that it's our own twist on it, it's our own fear, it's our own not enoughness that keeps acting and trying to put that electricity, that bigness of life, only in this box and out of that box. Something in us that says it's too much if it's everywhere. It's too much. Putting it in a box and then so that we can use it. So that we can have it for later when we're afraid we might need it, not trusting that it's everywhere. And so like the child and the kite and Ryokan writing that, the four ideograms on the kite or on the paper to make into a kite. That feeling of, oh, if you're not going to use it for anything, you're not going to try to sell it or frame it, you just are going to fly it. Then I'll happily make a priceless calligraphy on your paper. That for no reason. Feeling the shift inside from working with demand, so demand, responsibility, guilt, not trusting that if it's needed, it could be available anywhere. It's everywhere. And so we think we have to demand love, demand beauty or pleasure, safety. And we keep passing that on, especially piling it on ourselves. And so if we can feel that, that we've been educated in that kind of, as if we should always be busy looking for some kind of servant to command and demand, inside and outside. And feeling where actually we're more like some kind of a sail on a sailboat that would be, you know, or a kite in the wind, that would happily follow, be moved, be led by a wind that fills it for no reason. So a kind of leadership that's moving, that there's a willingness to follow that's not about demand or using or containing. And we're not also being used by life, we're being moved and filled, resonating with wholeness.
Resonating with?
Wholeness. Thank you for listening, and we'll just have our few minutes to get ready for the walk.